mental, spying is about understanding and influencing the scope of behavior from evil to exalted, and maneuvering through this emotional labyrinth in pursuit of valuable information otherwise unavailable. Espionage is also the foundation for covert action, which is not collection, but rather another tool of statecraft, a supplement to foreign policy. In espionage, I performed unevenly, so perhaps the CIA shrinks were partially right. My technical skills were horrible. My scientific knowledge was elementary. My foreign language capabilities were poor, and I could not pose as a non-American with any chance of success. Realizing my inclinations and my limitations in linguistic and cross-cultural integration, I never strove or aspired to be a polyglot operator. Instead, I toted the earthy, elemental culture of rural Georgia all over the globe. There was no real option, so I happily worked with the stalwart upbringing given me. I did make adjustments, such as moderating my thick drawl so European officials, African insurgents, Asian warlords, and Latin American diplomats could understand my English. I was less inclined to the exacting discipline of denied area operations, although I did travel and work under commercial alias in some restricted environments. My memory was good, not exceptional, except for cartography. I could read, remember, and follow maps with ease. My writing was adequate, and I labored to improve, starting at the farm, where an exasperated instructor explained to me the difference between active and passive voice. I had apparently slept through that English class. Communication, especially the crucial but sometimes mundane work of writing reports, is fundamental to espionage. Over the course of my career, I wrote thousands of reports, operational cables, and diplomatic messages, active and passive voice. I had apparently slept through that English class. Communication, especially the crucial but sometimes mundane work of writing reports, is fundamental to espionage. Over the course of my career, I wrote thousands of reports, operational cables, and diplomatic messages. At the farm, instructors placed unending emphasis on the imperative to produce quality intelligence for customers, no matter what branch of government. The paramount customer, of course, was the president, but there were many others, such as ambassadors, military commanders, legislators, law enforcement officers, diplomats, and analysts. They all needed intelligence to help inform their policy decisions and their operational plans. The ops officers captured and transmitted this intelligence in the form of a formal, structured report. There was a title, a date when the information was acquired, and a source byline which sought to characterize the agent's access to the information and his or her track record of reliability. Only those few CIA personnel required to manage or run the operation knew the source's identity. The intelligence report's customers did not need to know, but they did need to understand the quality of the source and the information. This was the purpose of the source byline. It protected the source's identity, but provided the customer a reference point, a sense of quality and context about the source. The instructors also taught us to draft an accompanying operational cable, transmitted in a narrow channel parallel to the formal intelligence report. This cable explained the operational aspects. In this way, the ops officer could provide the details of acquisition, that is, how and why the source obtained the information. Only a handful of CIA personnel involved in the case would receive this cable. Many operational questions, the instructors lectured, should be answered in this message. Did the source acquire the intelligence in the course of his normal duties? If not, what were the circumstances? How could the agent justify to others this access? What about the consequences of the agent's actions? Did the agent have confidence in his sources? Why? Did the agent have continuing access to this type of information? What other agenda may the source have had for providing this information, besides responding to the ops officer's requirements and guidance? Did the agent, or perhaps the subsources, seek to influence, not just inform? If so, why? The farm's instructors tested this repeatedly through a variety of exercises to discern fact-based intelligence from inference, speculation, and opinion. They made us separate intelligence from operational information. In one training episode, three different instructors playing different roles gave me three different versions of the same information. My mission was to remember all the information and write a single intelligence report from the combined three sources, filtering fact from all else. And, of course, I also drafted an accompanying operational cable. Then my instructors dissected my work, leaving me to contemplate the tangle of mangled parts that had been, in my mind, an intelligence masterpiece. This type of instruction, a sort of live-fire intellectual, social, and psychological drill, served as daily fare. It was a strange, intense, interpersonal, literary boot camp. It was fun and at times exhilarating. The most fascinating espionage lessons for me revolved around the woefully inexact art of recruitment. One instructor, a crusty veteran of indeterminate ethnicity, estimated that fewer than 20% of the officers recruited 80% of the best agents. According to him, there was no real way to know which officers would be the top recruiters until they deployed abroad. He explained that ace recruiters came in all shapes and sizes and exhibited a range of personalities. He cared little for the shrink's prognostications of performance. He maintained that each student must train with diligence, learn good habits, and go pitch prospective agents and keep learning. He maintained that all great recruiters constantly refined their craft. They always experimented and they always adjusted because all targets and all environments were different. The instructors outlined the ingredients of a recruitment operation. Mice. This stood for money, ideology, compromise, and ego. I thought of another, revenge, perhaps an extension of ego, but nonetheless powerful enough to warrant its own designation. Later in my career, in the universe of counterterrorism and war, I would learn and apply coercion from the intricately subtle to the massively kinetic. In almost all recruitments, an operations officer explores and exploits a combination of motivational factors. Each ops officer brings his own set of skills. Some splash bright colors on a grand canvas. Others sketch meticulously, layers of detail upon detail. Some forge relationships with prospective agents based on wild intuition, not knowing what they might render. Others plot and plan based on extensive psychological studies, trying to color by numbers. The successful ops officer must realize that he is not the most important part of a recruitment operation. The centerpiece of any recruitment operation is the recruitment target. The ops officer must not allow his own immediate objectives to block out the aspirations of the target. The ops officer must understand that the prospective agent has a vision also, although he may need help in expressing his needs. Uncovering and understanding the target's vision and enabling him to render an intelligence service is the ultimate objective. Then it gets even harder, because the geopolitical canvas is always shifting, sometimes ripping along unseen fault lines. Both the ops officer and the agent constantly wonder about each other, their respective capabilities, and their intent. The ops officer knows that the recruitment and the intelligence produced will never be perfect. He just hopes somebody recognizes and values the snapshot images. He also hopes that he and the agent can survive, grow, and expand their contribution to their operational and policy masters. My hunger to learn intelligence, to advance the mission, was insatiable. I studied and practiced day and night. At the farm, my performance was lousy in the beginning, mediocre by mid-course, and respectable by the final exercise. The instructors certified the majority of our class, including me, to serve abroad. Africa Division accepted my request to home base there. My first job as a certified operations officer was the same as before, when I was a CT on interim assignment, office labor. I may have graduated from the farm, but without field experience, I was really nothing but a clerk. Nevertheless, I happily worked while waiting for the paramilitary course and eventually an overseas assignment. While in this holding pattern, one day a tall fellow walked by my desk, stopped, wheeled around, and asked, "Who are you? What are you doing?" "I'm the desk officer," I replied, wondering who this brash guy might be. He was only a few years older than I. He had to be a field ops officer, I figured, given his swaggering confidence.